television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at Salon, Welcome to Post-Constitutional America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
Pleasure to be here, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And it strikes me as an enormous irony that one of the lies the Bush-Cheney administration sold us to get into the Iraq war was their claim that al-Qaeda was setting up a base in Iraq. And now it's becoming a grim truth as al-Qaeda in Iraq's Sunni resurgence against Maliki's corrupt and sectarian government gains momentum.
One of the things that has been clearer and clearer as time has gone by is that the disastrous mistakes in Iraq cannot be confined within the borders of Iraq. We're seeing now the most obvious signs of what many people have been observing over the years, that al-Qaeda has found a home where they once were not even particularly welcome, and that homeland in Iraq is allowing them to influence events in Syria and beyond. The mistakes of 2003 seem to never stop.
And in terms of al-Qaeda asserting itself, there were about over 800 al-Qaeda operatives sprung from Abu Ghraib prison recently in a very cleverly designed attack. Several of them were leaders scheduled for execution. So they're joining a resurgence that's happening. And my understanding is that the Sunni minority, who lost power due to the Bush-Cheney intervention and who traditionally, or at least for the longest time, ruled Iraq, they've always been sort of surly and dejected and despondent. And Maliki sort of more recently has gone after them, and that's made them even more feeling more marginalized and outraged. And I take it that al-Qaeda in Iraq is tapping into that reservoir of outrage.
Absolutely. This is the story of the surge and the failure of the surge. What we saw is that after the Sunnis lost power after the American invasion and the Shias rose to prominence, the Sunni people were marginalized. They were often pushed aside, if not outright subject to violence by the new government. And they were looking for someone to protect them. Al-Qaeda, to the extent that we can use that word to describe an amorphous organization, I mean, al-Qaeda is probably more of a concept or an idea than it is a particular organization that has a building someplace with a plaque on the wall or something like that. Al-Qaeda emerged as their protector and established itself quite effectively in Iraq. The United States attempted to drive a wedge between al-Qaeda, the foreign element, and the Sunnis in Iraq, and that's what we call the surge. It was designed to solve the problem that we had created when we kicked over the anthill in Iraq, the Sunni-Shia divide. It did not solve that problem. It had, at best, put it on hold, if you will. Basically, if you put enough American soldiers in between two groups, those two groups are going to be unable to struggle with each other. And that's what the surge really was. And as soon as we removed the troops, things started to fall apart. Let's not forget that Prime Minister Maliki first of all, went into office only because he had the support of the Iranians. And more importantly, within days of the American army's withdrawal, he put out an arrest warrant for his Sunni vice president. I think the message was very clear.
And he, of course, has shown his fealty towards Iran. The United States government has begged him to stop Iranian overflights to resupply the Assad regime in Syria, and he's basically given the back of his hand. Is there, as the situation deteriorates in the Sunni area, and as the country fragments more along the civil war outlines that we saw in the mid-2000s, is it possible that Maliki will ask the Americans to come back and referee the country again?
It's difficult to imagine why he would do that. It's possible to imagine that he might allow a few American organizations in as kind of a political tool. He wants money, he wants weapons, he wants what he can get from the Americans, and the price may be to allow small special forces groups or some CIA operation or something that is small and controllable and something he can keep a close eye on. But in terms of actually establishing a more comprehensive relationship with the United States, I don't quite see where his interest in that would be. He has a very powerful ally in Iran that has served him well, and he has served them well. The Sunnis are a problem for him, and he seems to have chosen a violent and politically divisive strategy to deal with them. I'm not quite sure where America would fit in the middle of all that. Our strategy in the Middle East appears to be to continually inject weapons and violence into every situation, as if the last 12 years have not shown us that that strategy, and I'm referring to Libya as much as anything, has simply not worked. Maliki, I think, is sitting very pretty and certainly doesn't need the United States. He may find the United States helpful in some small ways, but overall, I think the war was lost, and Maliki knows he was the winner.
And, well, Iran was the winner.
Well, of course. I mean, in the broader sense, the Iran was clearly the winner of the U.S.-Iraq war. Iran, in 2003, watched the United States in 2001, watched the United States clear the Taliban off of its eastern border. And the Taliban and the Iranians were certainly no friends of one another. And then in 2003, the United States cleared the Sunnis off of their western border. I think Iran probably sent George Bush a birthday card that year, thanking him for his service to the Ayatollahs. At the same time, Iran has benefited remarkably from the new Iraq. You mentioned the overflights, the smuggled weapons into Syria. Iraq has also been a very valuable partner in helping Iran sidestep U.S. sanctions. Enormous amounts of money and goods flow across the Iranian-Iraqi border. Iran is able to move its oil out that way. It's able to change currency and do its business that way. It's been quite a good run for the Iranians as far as this is concerned. And Maliki has gotten his share of the profits, if you will, as well. In particular, the Iranians helped him get his seat in the 2010 elections and continue to support him and continue to support him in his struggle against the Sunnis. So again, America is really not a player in any of this in any significant way. And the Iranians and the Iraqis really have no interest in changing the status quo right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at Salon, Welcome to Post-Constitutional America. But obviously, what's been unleashed now and this growing Sunni sectarian divide in this, particularly with this proxy war going on in Syria, I think is bound to bring in more and more regional players and expand. And the most logical place for it to expand, which it already has, is across the Syrian-Iraqi border. So How do you foresee a future here? Because either the war will go on forever, or not forever, but for a long time, or as Assad recently said, that he's winning militarily. So what would the – seems to me the consequences either way, whether Assad wins or loses, are going to be bad for Iraq's cohesion.
Absolutely. I think the easiest way to look at this is that there will be increasing violence across the Middle East, and in particular on the Syria-Iraq border. It's worth taking a deep breath and trying to sort these players out for a moment. The so-called rebels that are in Syria that are being supported by the United States are part and parcel with al-Qaeda. America, for public consumption, tries to pretend that we hand weapons to one rebel because he's not al-Qaeda, but we don't hand them to the guy next to him because he, quote, is al-Qaeda, as if we could possibly even know those things or possibly control them. So we're supplying weapons to the al-Qaeda side in Syria. Meanwhile, we are trying to get Maliki to allow us to intercede in his battle with the al-Qaeda people in Iraq, while Tehran supports Maliki and, reaching over the top of all this, supports Assad. So if that doesn't confuse your listeners, then they're better men and women than I am. The lesson here is very straightforward, and that is the boundaries in the Middle East are not lines on a map that make sense to anyone other than the British cartographers who drew them after World War I. The borders in the Middle East are based on religious connections, tribal connections, military-type alliances, if you will. And when the United States continues to think it is clever enough to muddle in these things, the results have been tragically repeated over and over and over again. As we talked earlier, the war in 2003 kicked over an anthill, disturbed a status quo that had held Iraq together for many years. The United States failed to replace that status quo with anything and simply walked away from it, hoping that that would be that. Instead, the problem has popped its head up again in Syria, where America continues to pour weapons in hopes of some type of a solution, without even really taking a moment to realize we're supporting the people in Syria that we're not supporting on the other side of the border in Iraq, which are threatening our embassies across the Middle East, and so on and so on and so forth. If you don't understand the rules, you probably shouldn't be playing. It's like the old saying, if you're not sure who the patsy is at the poker table, it's you.
Well, it's pretty amazing to think that Bush Sr. never talked to his son. Because I know Brent Scowcroft, and he was one of the few people that tried to warn them against this ridiculous war. And he knew about the time of Bush Sr.'s first Iraq war that you couldn't go into Baghdad and you'd be fighting a guerrilla war, which is exactly what happened when the Sun and the neocons and Cheney, pushing it more than anybody, came up with this ridiculous idea. And I think in many ways they used they conned the kid into getting into this war based upon the sort of notion that he was going to clean up his father's mess. You know, his father should have gone into Baghdad, and this time Junior's going to show Dad. Boy, what a catastrophe it's turned out to be.
And you wish that the lessons of history might be learned by someone, but again, I have to look back at the current administration's intercession in Libya, where, again, there was a relative status quo. The United States had, for whatever reason, reopened diplomatic relations with Gaddafi, and yet we kicked over another anthill without really understanding the complexity of relations inside of Libya, the interplay between the different groups that had simmered under Gaddafi's central control. And then we essentially walked away from it. We're left with a chaotic situation there that pops its head up every once in a while, and with a Benghazi-like incident. The weapons that were cut loose in Libya have found their way into other parts of northern Africa and fueled the trouble in Mali. It appears that the United States was using some of those weapons, smuggling them out of Libya through Turkey into Syria in kind of a mini Iran-Contra scandal, if you will. These things are complex systems. They are very complex problems. And simply, crudely, walking in and declaring a dictator gone and hoping that democracy sprouts up in the desert somehow is just foolish. And we've seen now two administrations in a row commit these same errors. I wish they would read last week's newspapers before they take next week's actions.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Peter Van Buren, the only part, and we haven't talked about this, the only part of Iraq that seems to work is the Kurdish part, and it works largely because they're completely autonomous, right?
Absolutely, and the Kurds have sort of fallen off everyone's screen, but it's very important to remember that there were three distinct groups in Iraq, the Shias, the Sunnis, and the Kurds. Kurdistan, the northern, what used to be northern Iraq, is an independent nation in every single sense of the word, except perhaps a sign on the desk at the United Nations. Kurdistan has its own military, it has its own currency, it has its own government, it elects its own officials, it signs contracts and negotiates with corporations and companies. It's the only part of Iraq that is finding prosperity and figuring out how to monetize its oil. And it no longer is a part of Iraq in any realistic sense. The problem, of course, with Kurdistan is that its borders are not the black lines on the map. What Kurds believe Kurdistan is extends into Iran and into Turkey. The war between the Kurds and the Turks has been on low simmer for quite some time. And that, too, will have to find its own solution, its violent end, given that the United States has taken the cap off of it and then left the Kurds and the Turks and the Iranians to sort things out on their own. Right now it's quiet, and the Turks and the Kurds have taken a summer off, apparently, but that violent situation will find its resolution as well, even as the Sunnis and Shias continue theirs.
Well, and Iraq's oil, you know, which you're supposed to, remember they told us that the Iraq war would be paid for by the oil that would flow in copious quantities. My understanding is that the oil has not been particularly developed, and that you mentioned earlier that that Iran, that's under embargo, is selling its oil through Iraq, which is going on. So, I mean, at least the notion that a lot of people had, and even Alan Greenspan said this war is all about oil. If that was what it was about, that was another incredible piece of incompetence on the part of the Bush-Cheney administration. If they were if they were going there to bring democracy and to grab the oil, it looks like they're wrong on both counts.
Iraq literally floats on oil. The oil in Iraq is closer to the surface than practically anywhere else in the world, and there are incredible quantities of it under the ground. The problem is there's a difference between oil in the ground and oil that can make its way to international markets. Iraq, the infrastructure of Iraq was circa 1963 and basically hasn't been tidied up, maintained, or improved ever since then. In addition, Iraq lacks the electrical capacity to do what you need to do to get oil out of the ground. Iraq has a single port to the world, which is crowded with ships bringing food in to try to keep the population from starving to death after the United States destroyed so much during the invasion, and that port doesn't have any more room in it to move oil out. In addition, the security situation is so horrendous that international companies are reluctant to make significant investments, and whenever things do start to get built, they're very easily torn down or destroyed by the bad guys, if you will. Finally, oil is a national resource, and Iraq lacks a government that represents the nation. And so there's infighting and pushing and shoving over whose money it is and whose oil it is. The last thing, of course, that was not thought about was that you need a lot of water to extract oil. Basically, we all know that water and oil don't mix, and so you pump clean water in, not salt water, clean water in to force the oil out, and Iraq lacks the ability to desalinate enough water and has no fresh water sources that are significant enough to do the job. And all these things were left out of the equation. I suspect if we got Dick Cheney drunk in a bar one night, what he would have said is, well, after we finish the war, Halliburton was going to go in there and make another $1 trillion providing all that for the Iraqis. But that's a pretty lame excuse at this late date. The war started 10 years ago, and Iraq is producing less oil now than it did before the war.
Well, Peter Van Buren, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. And through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at Salon, Welcome to Post-Constitutional America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the suspension today of 13 baseball players, including three-time American League MVP Alex Rodriguez.